Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello, welcome to The Salon. Our guests today are Jane Boston and Matthew Mills. Jane Boston is a principal lecturer at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, University of London, where she leads the MA/MFA in Voice Studies, Teaching and Coaching, and heads up the International Network in Voice. She has extensive experience of embodied voice, communication skills and leadership training with business leaders, civil servants in the Foreign Office, and within community groups. In 1980, she co-founded Brighton's Siren Theatre, which reformed in 2014 to perform and develop new compositions in relation to changes in feminist performance practice. Matthew Mills is a consultant speech and language therapist in voice and communication, voice coach, supervisor, musician, and writer. He has worked at the Charing Cross Gender Identity Clinic in London since 2009 and facilitates individuals in discovering their authentic voice and communication in therapy and performance contexts. The author of a number of studies on voice and gender, Matthew originally trained as an actor, singer and pianist at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama and Trinity College London, and worked in television, theatre, radio and film for 20 years. In this exchange, Jane and Matthew think out loud about voice and identity, asking questions about how we come to sound ourselves, how we vocally switch between the public and the private, what physical and cultural choices we make to sonically express our interiority, the consequences of not being heard, and the bridging of vocal space and temporalities needed to build resonant communities. This conversation was recorded on Zoom between London and Brighton on the 19th of June, 2020.
Jane, here we are.
Here we are. It's funny. It's funny, sort of having a conversation in this way. The kind of nerves build up when it,
yes.
I welcome our conversations over the times that we've met.
Yes.
Different places, often in the Hampstead Theatre. You know, grabbing a moment, gathering an hour. And then the thought of this is our hour, it becomes kind of highly charged, doesn't it?
Exactly. The whole sort of waiting and being accepted into a sort of a sonic space, if you like, you know, which is being listened to and recorded. Interesting, kind of really just kind of reflecting a little bit on the sort of hesitation moments, the sort of pauses, the ers, the ums, the sort of bread and butter, which is a sort of flow of interaction. I think for me, we're looking at, I think, of something about interiority and know, the sonic expression of interiority. I was straight in there thinking about these incredibly important moments before the moment.
Yeah.
You like, you know, the sort of our waiting moments before we decide to be recorded, etc. You know, press the button and it happens in this digital sonic space. It's an interesting transaction, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had a couple of these over the last few days. Just that moment of being asked to have a 10-minute slot about what is voice online, and then compression in my head about, you know, how will I say enough in 10 minutes to reflect this world that I've been in for so long, my whole professional life, the kind of stakes, and yet the whole idea of just being grounded and still and allowing something simple to emerge against the weight of expectation. And I suppose I find myself in that kind of conundrum. In a way, an hour is much more leisurely than a 10-minute what is voice in the world today. But there's nevertheless that sense of the thought behind arriving here, and so many feelings, so much history, so many moments that you and I have had, let alone the moments we have in our working week, all to this point.
Yes, exactly. And sort of an hour isn't a sound bite. We're not nibbling, are we?
No, we're not nibbling, Manny. Definitely not.
Yeah.
I was eagerly awaiting, in a sense, your sound sonic cue. And it came as I was in the middle of my late afternoon admin, and I just read the words first. You know, that's so interesting because words are one of my great loves in a good day. And I was very emotional, just suddenly, before I listened to the song.
Yes, this is the song Home, which is from The Wiz, by Charlie Smalls, 1975. And what's been so very, very deeply moving for me in this, particularly in this period of, which we're calling lockdown, I might call locked up.
Yeah.
This sort of space, if you like, where I am in my home, but I have been struggling to find that sense of home quality, I think, in my wanderings through myself, I think, really. And I think what particularly moved me, as you know, one of my backgrounds is I work with people who are trans and non-binary, and that sort of search for the expression, if you like, that, you know, that interior sense of self, you know, being expressed through voice. And here is a program, it comes from Pose, and MJ Rodriguez is a trans actor and a wonderful musician, and she gives in the program her rendition of a music Home, which is from The Wiz. And that in itself is a reworking of a very sort of, if you like, mainstream sense of kind of Technicolor, you know, sort of all white brilliance, sort of that kind of, and this already is a sort of reworking, and it's an interesting remodeling. And I think that what it speaks to is that backdrop of different disenfranchised communities, disenfranchised voices, if you like. And I think that sort of is very, very, very deep.
I was struck by the melancholic, I suppose I always veer towards the, as people said, why do I never sing happy songs? But there's something of the key, the gospel quality, but also the notion in the lyric that the world's gone and changed.
Mm.
That quoting the lyric, suddenly my world's gone and changed its face, but I still know where I'm going. I've had my mind spun around in space.
Yes, exactly.
And there's something of the disorientation of having lost a place, or perhaps never even had a place, which in a way goes, there is a link, and I often try to make links, and some people say, well, don't make a bridge, just say these are different. But the song I sent you about about the whales losing their navigation systems, there is an interesting sort of connection there, isn't there, between how we found our way
and
it is to lose it, and the consequences of losing it, you know, the deep consequences of not, of being dispossessed, of being outside our place of security, you know.
Yes, it is deeply disorientating, and from us we wail about it, don't we? That remembering, I think, or regathering of the self, of the vocal self, that cuts through a sort of expectation, is highly potent. For me, I think in all this work, you know, the sort of moments of discovering the song and just discovering my identity and working with people and their identity, it's a kind of richness of liminality. You know, these places of threshold, I find a deeply potent to me. Threshold, the place of consciousness, the place of arrival, you know, and as facilitators of voice, both for ourselves and for others, we have to be, I think, extremely sensitive to these moments. And here we are, you know, sort of in this very sped up world where you and I now, we've entered into a sort of digital threshold. We've stepped into a threshold very quickly, and these things can be very moved across very swiftly, and they can be quite disturbing.
And I
think the observation of the way that we transition literally through vocal time and space is extremely potent to me. I think the losing of our way and the re-sensing of what, of who we are and what we are and how we reach out to people and how we
when I just sometimes wonder whether there is a sort of retro mournfulness in my approach, as if it's not as if I know there is a place of home that is an ideal. It, you know, there isn't that ideal place, but there's a longing in there for knowingness, I guess, knowing oneself or being at home, being comfortable, being heard, being loved, if you like. And perhaps those are all the ingredients of that desire. I know that there's no place to go, but there's a place to be thought about and imagined. Yes. And these pieces that you sent, the piece that you sent, takes me straight to that. That really quite a lump in my throat about it, the if only, or what can I use in my dream life to bring me solace, to bring me richness, to bring me back to myself, I guess.
Yes.
I felt separated.
Perhaps in all of us, there's a sense of not being well knitted together with our voice, perhaps, or you know, because we experience it, you know, internally, and yet the perception of others in a social space, we are sending out that sort of internal sense of ourselves, which is then being interpreted, and so we get sort of feedback really, and then we start to perhaps engage with or embody those external sort of influences, and then perhaps we might hear back our voices, if you like, you know, that sense of it coming back to us. That kind of longing for that comfort and that sense of home, that sense of our own resonance somehow, that, you know, is that warmth that we know somewhere there, perhaps, is it's a very human thing. It's a sort of vanishing point, isn't it? As the sun goes down, it's down across the across the hills and up the lane, and there it is, sort of thing. We're drawn to it.
Yes.
So much.
But I'm very aware that in our different occupations, you know, you as a therapist and me in the studio with training voice teachers. And when we did the work, we'd done some work together over the last few years, and I was so interested by that fixing the signal idea, you know, that voice teachers come into the work to do something about the voice, to do something.
Yes, yes.
Historically, that's been the process. You do something because the voice isn't conforming, or it's not working, or it's not right. You
know? Yeah, exactly.
And then we come to hear your work in the clinic, of the voices in the clinic. And that I was so interested by that idea of self-choice, the voice that each of us decides we need, the voice inside, the voice that we construct that is not so relational to the world outside, but because it's we will accept it. The aesthetics of voice in voice training has been very dominant after a certain kind of sound. And it certainly gave me something to think about, and my students, when we had to think, well, these voices that you brought to us, recordings, were voices that had been, they'd arrived at their own satisfaction. The voice was the voice they reflected.
And that's the process, you know. I think like in the studio, the training of actors, singers, vocal practitioners, anybody who wishes to use voice to express in some way, we all do, don't we? You know, we all move through thresholds and you know, platforms of performing ourselves, whether gender, sexuality, what, you know, ourselves as teachers and voice practitioners. And I absolutely believe we must start from ourselves. We must have our understanding of our own, what we bring to the process. So certainly as a speech and language therapist specialising in voice, you know, having been an actor and singer and having been a music teacher, I've never really felt like I fitted, you know, completely in one. You know, I'm not a scientist, I'm all, if you like, but I think that it's not narcissistic, it's existential, really. It's that thing of, I have to start with me and make sense of the world in order for me to know where I begin and end, and know where my thresholds are, and know where my vulnerabilities are, so that I can therapeutically, in my case, use that knowledge to scaffold and to create opportunities of exploration and discovery for people who are desperately struggling with the idea that there is this sense of conformity which is going to get me to live, which is going to get me not murdered, which is going to get me to be gendered in the way that I want to be, etc. And so there's huge cost to being authentic, absolutely huge cost. And I love the, you know, certainly as a therapist, but I think it speaks beyond my own personal sort of therapeutic explorations into myself. And I know in the way that my voice, I think, has changed over the years since I trained with Patsy many years ago at Guildhall in the early 90s, Jeanette and Annie Morrison, that those spaces in myself have opened up because I have been brave enough to allow occupancy, myself to occupy them, to open those doors and the threshold. The work of Michael White and David Epstein are narrative therapists, they're family therapists, but White developed this sort of rites of passage metaphor from Van Gennep. He talked about sort of the migration of identity. He did this in context, particularly people who are suffering with addiction. We've worked with a number of narrative therapists, so we've developed this. We've taken a little bit further, really, to think about, well, what is this migration of vocal identity that we might do, if you like, in terms of going on a journey which starts with this place of contacting ourselves, the contacting that moment of the interior, and separating from, if you like, the thing which has sustained us and no longer is useful. So that moment of contact of self, of interiority, if you like, is the spark that takes us on this new journey. And when we set off, we don't know where we're going. And then this opens up this idea of we move through the landscapes betwixt and between in breath and the out breath, the vocal landscape, the highs and the lows, the textures, we embody those. And then we find our vocal resonant community. We find our political community. We find our emotional community, our vocal community, really. And on the way, we hope, you know, certainly as therapists, we hope that people are disorientated because you have to sort of be shaken up. And I think this lockdown I wouldn't say a great example of it. I think it's a very traumatic example of it. You know, we are absolutely shaken up by this liminality in which we are in. We don't know where we're going. And this business about coming back to new normality. Well, of course, we will never go back. You can't existentially go back to a place that has been. But that at some point, you know, that you arrive, you refind, you know, I suppose, you know, that what I could hear in MJ Rodriguez's rendition of Home was this longing for home. But vocally, in that vocal performance, there was this wonderfully secure sense of home.
The track now playing is protected by copyright and we are unable to replay it on Lend Me Your Ears. Please refer to the podcast page on our Auralia.space for full credits and a link to listen. Thank you.
In terms of, this is a set of vocal folds that is a certain length and certain size that may have occupied a certain habitual pitch and a certain, you know, kind of resonance, if you like, that may have been typically evoked in a certain gender performance, if you like. Mm-hmm. And yet this woman is able to produce many, many colours and textures sing this extraordinarily beautiful way.
Yeah, really.
Really draws us in. And is also not afraid of you know, the strength and really opening the voice up. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it's a solo performance that has glamour attached to it. And, you know, I remember when you said you'd been watching Pose and in the lockdown, the kind of solace in a way. And I really wanted to kind of get some of the back catalogue and see it, but I haven't, but I will do. Yeah. But I'm very aware that my sonic intervention is very much about, in a way, it's a coming out for me in the voice world, because I think I've split the kind of political radical place that I came into this world with, world of voice, was as a lesbian feminist activist. And it really didn't have any place in the conservatoire that I later joined. I found it quite problematic to join that experience, that will, the transformational will of the work that I had for the world. And when I met the sort of training environment, you were at Guildhall, I taught at Central and I trained at Central in the voice. It was a long period of feeling quite outside the traditions, the norms, the aesthetics, and the heterosexual norms of actor training, which are still, you know, we're dealing with them at the moment.
Yes.
Not just the heterosexual, but the kind of the white, racial,
cis-normative.
So I took it as a sort of singular journey, really. But the reason I sort of bring the song as a siren collective effect is that I found my voice in the collective. So I'm always in awe of the kind of soloist and the position taken to be able to fully express the emotion as MJ Rodriguez does, you know, the beautiful solo torch song. For me, the performance was about finding a voice in a communal political ensemble.
Yes.
And a slow burn about trying to find a lyrical voice, a writing voice in the company of others. But I know that without a doubt I wouldn't have got this far had I not had the courage of the group, that the group gave me courage. And I was reading your book and used some of the commentary that you had documented about the importance of the group formation in your work, in an aiding and supporting the voice that each individual decides on or needs, you know.
Yes.
I was just really struck by the comparisons in my own journey with that.
And also, actually, in context of the programme, I mean, I know that obviously MJ Rodriguez has that ability to be able to, the technique to be able to get up and do that.
Yeah, really.
But, really. And I think that is also a wonderful moment for the trans and non-binary community, where people are not having to apologise in any way for their place to express so beautifully, you know, that piece. Yeah. And I think that in itself, for me, is a huge vocal political act, which does actually speak to the community, because I think that there have been times where, you know, there's a big debate, isn't there, about sort of the authenticity of using Northern Irish accents, Northern Irish actors to do the Northern Irish accent, etc. All those debates around, you know,
the Dharma School.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, cultural misappropriation, all that kind of stuff, really. And here we have, you know, really for the first time, trans and non-binary queer political people writing about queer political issues in the 80s and 90s at the backdrop of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And here we are in another epidemic. And I think that it's really caught people, because it's about kind of people being disenfranchised and probably never really feeling like they had a home. And I think there was such a huge debate around what safe spaces are at the moment. Mm. And, you know, it got me thinking about safe vocal spaces, you know, what we do to facilitate people to find safety in their own sense of vocal self. I think the sense of community and being held by community of choir and voice is absolutely essential in that creation, really.
I was, one of my students on Zoom just said that what she was missing most was the courage of the vibration of the others. Mm. You know, there's just no replacing that online. So I've been thinking about that practice quite a lot and trying to find a, not an answer, but part of the journey is to self-verify, to keep reminding us that we are there. We can give ourselves the contact. If no one else can contact us, we can actually feel something of our place in the room, in the space, the gravity. It was a real cry from the heart that she missed the courage, the presence of the vibration of others around her to then step forward, to feel confident to reach other pitches and do other things, you know.
Yes, yes.
It's got a mournful place, isn't it?
It does absolutely. I think so, and I think where we are topping and tailing and saying, well, between this point in time and this point in time there will be this much sound and it will be able to be recorded, etc., you know, the kind of, you know, I suppose why I liked things are in the theatre recorded now, and you know, we benefit, you know, from watching performances, you know, that we might have missed, and that's, you know, it's a different experience, an interesting experience actually. Mm-hmm. I was watching Gillian Anderson's Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh yeah.
You know, online. I hadn't seen it at the Young Bit when it was on, so it was kind of an interesting thing. Here I am, a digital consumer of this live entity, you know, and it was filmed well, that one actually felt that kind of there was one could feel the audience as well, as it wasn't sort of very flat. So
right.
I was glad of that. I think absolutely, yeah, the sort of the way that we step into risk and the way that we watch others and hear others and feel others stepping into risk in digital spaces is all up for more exploration.
Much more exploration. So have you been running groups at this time?
We've done some. We're in mourning. We talk about mournful, but we are in mourning.
Yeah.
Because I think that we realise that we can't translate, you know, some of the spontaneity of the work that we have been doing. We're trying to find those moments where, you know, when you press happy to continue, go, admit into all those things that you know, are the digital moments of stepping in, how we occupy those, and we observe those thresholds, and we know them to be the thresholds in ourselves, really, of suddenly being seen, suddenly being heard, and suddenly making the choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that silence is very, very important in a digital world as well. I think that the digital world has to get used to pauses. I'm quite a disfluent speaker. I had a stammer when I was a kid. I don't have stammering as part of my core speaking sort of pattern, but I do have a certain sort of wandering or a kind of, you know, gathering, if you like. You know, I always had that. And so some repetitions, etc. You know, and the ers and the ums and the I'm chewing and processing my words almost as I'm speaking. So the moments of arrival, if you like, you know, at the consonantal of the vowel, you know, it's taking a little bit of, you know, has an indirect root sometimes. And I think those things need to be.
I mean, I really miss the signals that give me courage to go on, that I'm thinking as I open my mouth in relation to, oh, the thresholds of boredom in the group, the tiredness, the willingness to go on, the different things that occur as we are in the moment together, that I gauge by other things, the physical signals, the unconscious signals that we're picking up, the atmosphere in the room, the vibes.
Yes, that's right.
The renegotiations online are really, really a steep learning curve, I think, to cope with the silence and to trust.
That's right, exactly. That, you know, that there is a protocol, there is an etiquette, I think, in kind of how we do set these things up. And we have to, you know, a little bit like, well, walking into a physical space where there are chairs and people sit, and then, you know, there's a gathering time, and then the work begins, really. And I think that probably in a digital space, it does have to be perhaps a little bit more directive, certainly initially. And those kind of moments of breakout, or those moments of quietness or reflection, have to be, everything has to be much more, named, I think, at this time. Whilst it's new, because it's new, and I think the naming of it makes it. There's your home, really, isn't it? There's your sense of it being home, because you've gone, that's what it is. So take a moment now to. One thing I particularly actually started to feel enjoyment of in the work is I have been able to, you know, do some really detailed voice work with people in terms of voice quality and pitch and resonance. And I think it's worked because I've been literally honouring the ears and the vocal folds, etc., of the person I'm working with. Can you hear this in me? I think I can hear this in you. So we're reaching that sort of collaborative place. We do it in the room, in the physical space, but I think...
Is there something that's added to that journey in some way?
Yeah, being brave on the part of the vocal facilitator, the vocal practitioner, sort of perhaps it's not teacherish or didactic, but I think one has to sort of perhaps... put that initiation out there in terms of being transparent. And I think that's the thing which will probably invite those people who are coming to explore with us, gives them the signal that we are working it out and minting it together, because we're minting it for ourselves as much as for them, if you like,
I've certainly noticed that leading with courage, not being afraid of the silence of the little boxes, but that I really recognize that sense of the invitation, and the invitation to reflect, to be quiet, to examine. It's different than the in-present situation. And I think the setting of the frame, as you say, we are all here, we're on the gallery, those are setting the rules of being on the gallery. And it still seems so new. It really does, though.
And the language that we have, gallery, it's a sort of it's a place of perhaps looking and being curious to witness, but maybe not. Perhaps it's not more of a visual space than a
auditory one. Or
yes, maybe. I don't know, right? Maybe it's be.
Well, I think we're doing a lot of working out about, are we looking? Do we need to look? A lot of, I don't know if this is just to women, but a lot of women say they get very disturbed by seeing themselves at the same time as you're conducting something. You know, the idea of being preoccupied because you can see yourself on the gallery.
Sure.
And that's going to have some impact. It does. I feel it.
Yes. I mean, it was the thing that I certainly, when I started to Zoom in lots of meetings, I don't want to be seeing myself here. It's like looking in the mirror, isn't it? Kind of, and it's distracting. And yes, you can turn your self view off.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, and I would do that in a one-to-one sort of therapy session. But I think when it is a group, I don't know, somehow it becomes slightly helpful to see what one's to, or maybe what or aware of what other people are looking at in me.
Yeah.
It's not looking at me, but you know. So it's a phenomenon.
It is a phenomenon, and we have to face things in ourselves, I suppose, that we haven't had to face. I mean, I don't see myself in the group when I'm normally in the studio, and I can evade the gaze if I wish to. I can get up and move around in a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
It's something Kristen Linklater often said to me: "You know, just stand still in front of the group. Just stop, why are you wandering around?" And I think there's a sort of there was an incipient sort of sense of escaping the role in some ways. I could escape the role of the pedagogue at times, which in Zoom I can't escape the role. You know?
Yes.
I have to be in that position. It is where I am.
And I think it's the same with the therapist. That sort of, there's this phrase therapeutically that all that is within me is in the room, and all that is within the client is in the room, because it's present. And so has that sense of feeling, picking up on the sort of congruence of what's being said, and that's to do with the body language, and often, you know, and a lot of these signals we've lost in terms of, you know, physicality and smell and body language and eye contact, obviously, because when I'm, you know, looking at you, or, you know, I'm looking at you now, but that might not look like I'm quite looking at you because I'm not looking at my camera, and here I am with my camera, and that might now. You know, so it's a little bit one removed, isn't it, you know, overall. And also I have to wear glasses to do screen work, and I don't do that in the room with people, so that's a new adjustment for me. But when I'm in the room with somebody, it's like I am aware of the things that are stirring in me, but my energy is very much flowing towards the one who's come for the consultation, if you like. And it is a little disturbing to remember myself within that context, but I think useful as one if one's doing it kindly.
Kindness. We need a lot of that.
We do. I keep coming back to this, to the business of sort of, we've talked a bit about, you know, liminality, these places of betwixt and between, stepping into different spaces. Digital spaces, spaces of us, spaces of being with people, and community spaces where one is seen and heard, one goes on a journey, and one is disorientated, and one then might come to a place of thinking, wow, gosh, something settled in me before I then move on to the next part of the phase, and I'm at another threshold. And at the point of threshold is the point of arrival and departure. It's the point of knowing what one is bringing to that moment, but also what one is sacrificing, what one is leaving behind. If I'm going on a journey, I need to know what I'm taking with me and what I'm leaving behind. And I think, you know, that's also, you know, vocally, certainly what I'm getting people to explore really is that sort of sense of working out the losses and the gains, I suppose. Something also about temporality as well within this very, very strange time, and your beautiful words and the sea and the eternal nature of the sea, the community of the sea and the community of your voices and the political community that I hear in your words speaks across time. So the elders, the vocal elders that are in another place, if you like, Linklater and Berry and people, their work is vibrationally with us, if you like, and so we can make the then now, can't we, by locating that within ourselves somehow. So yeah. It takes vocal temporality, and it's not linear. It really isn't.
It's not linear. No, I do feel keenly the loss of Kristen, as we've spoken about, and yes. Voice community does. But I was just reading about the idea that we're all, it's a small place, this globe, really, and the time we have to honour each other. There's something about, I go to images about nature and the whales, if you like, and the idea of my home, I suppose, is that we have something we can work out together, all of us, in terms of our journeys, this long evocation that you gave us about the journeying and the myriad encounters and the thresholds that we cross. And so it's a philosopher that I was reading about saying that we have just a critical small space in this globe, and everything counts. You know, every signal going every which way has some impact on us, you know. And I suppose I find solace in that idea that there's something bigger, as well as this deep individual voice seeking we do, but that we have some impact beyond that which we can really manage at any given time, but that we have a responsibility somehow. Whales, us, you know, these us as inhabitants crisscrossing our journeys together, and the richness of that, the responsibility of that, the gift of that.
Yes.
You know, the idea that certain people want to just get the hell out and get to Mars. the kind of absence, getting away, and when in fact we are responsible for what we've got.
Yeah, that's right.
The sounds we make.
Yeah, exactly. And I know that sort of speech therapy has had a sort of history of maybe perhaps fixing voice, as you were, or rehabilitating voice. But certainly the parts that I work in, it is voice coaching, if you like, within the NHS, there's never, you know, what healing means, if you like, or kind of state of health means, if you want to, is there's never a place of return to what was. It's always a new place, a new understanding, a new consciousness, and a new sense of, and that comes from really occupying, you know, where you're at right now, and not denying where you're at right now, and saying, you know, this is my voice, and these are its possibilities, and these are the things that are within me, and these are the things that I can send out and meet other people.
And they're in us, and the relational capacity, how we are colliding or meeting or chancing off each other, but the beauty of that, in a sense, the beauty to stay richly involved with. Yvonne Bonifon talked about in his work the queering.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah, it's good. And talks about the vocalic body, that there we touch. We're touching each other's worlds with our sound.
Yes.
With the meaning of us and the shaping meaning of us and the meaning that's changed because I'm encountering your sonic world.
Yes.
So those are the things that give me great I don't know, heart somehow, but that we've got a responsibility to stay alive to that, to be nuanced for those voices, particularly in the discussions that we're having at the moment, which are so divided. We can get so deeply, and we have to expose the divisions. But also there's a notion of moving in recognition of embracing, really, listening, really listening.
Yes.
How enriching that is, you know.
Yes, that taking time.
Yeah.
Taking time. And I think, you know, the speed of certainly the digital space, you know, it's all accountable, isn't it? Literally, it's accountable.
Yeah.
Thing, entity, you know, and I suppose our market economy is such that you know, we give teaching time, the number of hours and study time, etc., and all those things are potentially countable, but it's the quality of the exploration, it's the quality of the therapeutic conversation, it's the quality of the of the boundary that is set up and explored together that enables the sort of fertility, if you like, of the exploration to echo out. I love that work of Boniface.
Yes, isn't it?
I mean, this is the queerness that, you know, which is the sort of, which is the world of pose and the whole business of walking those balls as they did in you know that tradition, that's Latin.
Yeah.
Latino and African American tradition of kind of, you know, what we know, having a fantastic sort of sense of dress, you know, exploring and expressing oneself, sexuality, gender, and the rest of it, and being the arbiters, if you like, being the judges of that community, validating themselves really, and then the whole sort of the voguing, you know, which people think Madonna. They attribute to Madonna, but it's actually
pinched.
Much older than that. It's part of that community, but it's a dance of resilience, and it's a dance of being seen, and there is a vocal component to it, you know, and that sort of queer sense of voice for me is definitely a political thing.
It's
very personal, personal, because it takes diversity. These words are often, you know, used very quickly, aren't they? But that sense of it's okay to be what we are, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting that coming back to the risk taking, because more and more we've spoken about this a lot as a pedagogue in voice training in the conservatoire, the position I don't want to take is one of pronouncement, but it's about setting the guidelines for exploration for the voice that ultimately the individual wishes to choose, but set in a context that also have to change the context sometimes of the perception, because perception is a cruel one at times. That's the external expectation, the stereotype. You know, working on those multiple fronts, ensuring that there's activation to challenge or resist the perceptions that would squash you or denounce you or place you somewhere else. And I find that quite complex. It is complex, obviously, but actually trying to fold it into a pedagogical stance, which is saying, be aware of the perception, shape the perception, but also be true to your own journey.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, the simultaneous journeying there.
Yes. I suppose it's kind of getting a very conscious sort of sense of what is being asked of you vocally in a particular context, and knowing really very clearly what that is.
Yeah.
And then you can choose with your instruments that you've explored it, you can choose to code switch and occupy that sort of moment of Noel Coward or you know, heightened internet, all those things.
Yeah.
You can do that. You can have a vocal performance which meets that moment. And I think that's the same with so perhaps gendered perception, really, certainly in a binary sense, you know, a kind of a non-binary vocal sense, I might call, you know, is that liminality, really, is that sort of sense where all things are possible, and it's not actually defined by, but you know, by the polarity, it's something, you know, something queer and beyond, really. It's both within and without, and betwixt and between, and not defined by it. But I think if the vocal person, that brave soul, can speak their sense and understand what is being asked of them, I think that's our role as facilitators of a voice, that we've enabled people to understand what might be expected of them. But
exactly, I think the answer is to make them safe in the instability of the inquiry.
I love it. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, indeed. Because it is quicksilver, isn't it? It is material. It is both forward and retrograde.
I know. Oh dear, what a journey, eh? I mean, it's a privilege. It's a privilege, Dom. It's a privilege to be able to speak with you, to have the time to do this, to think about these things. It's what I always wanted to do, really. And it's so much time in the studio of doing over the years.
Yes.
But I've also, what I've really welcomed is being able to have these kinds of conversations, to think about the doing, the knowledge that is the doing, you know.
Yes, exactly.
I've always had such a strong connection to that, making sense of the doing. You
know? Yes. And I love the symbols that we've discussed together, and how they relate to our vocal journeys, how to our student journeys, our patient journeys, our client journeys, our services or journeys, whatever, you know, all that.
Yeah.
You know, how those things are so interrelated.
Yeah. Fabulous.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Dano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.